to move your nonprofit forward? You've come to the right place. Welcome to the Nonprofit Architect, where we are giving you the actionable steps you need to launch and grow your nonprofit organization. Now, here's your host, Travis Johnson.
Hey, Travis Johnson here, Nonprofit Architect, helping you build a stronger nonprofit. I'm here with Nicole Hyde today. If you love the show, love what we're doing, go to patreon.com/nonprofitarchitect. Give 10 bucks a month, contribute, help keep the show on the air. It won't cost you an arm or leg. You won't even notice in your monthly budget, but you'll help keep the show on for everyone else. Nicole, how are you doing today?
Travis, thank you so much for having me. I'm doing wonderful. I'm looking forward to our show, and I'm so excited to be here and share my knowledge with everyone.
Heck yeah, that's why I have you on. This isn't a free ride. I need you to do some work here this morning. So tell us what you do with Rosedale CPA.
Sure, Rosedale Audrey CPAs. I'm an accountant. I specialize with nonprofits, and they're typically anywhere in the range from revenues of 20,000 to about 50 million. My background is an outside accountant where I go in, I prepare the tax return, I do the financial audit, or they hire me on a whole different level and I act as their outsourced director of finance or controller for the larger entities. We also have another firm called CPA Tax Partners, which is our international or virtual firm where we have international clients and nonprofits whose mission might be based abroad, but their campus or their office is in the United States. So we do their tax and accounting work for them.
That's really cool. And nonprofits, usually especially startup nonprofits, kind of the tax impact of a nonprofit is kind of like an afterthought. They get through the year, they get their paper together, and like, oh man, I might have to file taxes. In a nonprofit work, we call that a 990. What can you tell us about 990s and the different types of filing for nonprofits?
Sure. So there's three different types of 990s that nonprofits can file. They can file a 990N or a postcard, and that's if they have less than $50,000 in gross contributions or receipts. Then there's the 990EZ, which is anywhere from the $50,000 to $200,000 mark and no more than $500,000 in assets. And then they have the 990, which is anywhere $200,000 and up and assets exceeding $500,000. So the deadline for the 990s is May 15th, or if your fiscal year ending, it's the 15th day of the fifth month after your fiscal year.
15th day after the fifth month, May 15th. Okay. Different than April 15th for your regular filing. You get an extra month.
Extra month. Yeah.
Extra month. That's good because sometimes you need that extra month. So what kind of situations will nonprofits find them in where they actually have to account for other taxes?
When you say other taxes, typically when they're a nonprofit, they are recognized under the 501c3 status of the Internal Revenue Code. So they're tax exempt. However, there are some times where they might deviate from their mission and there could be something called unrelated business income tax. And you typically see that when they, for example, a community organization was running a gym and they had a membership or due subscription, a monthly fee to come use that gym. If that's not directly tied into their mission somehow, they could be in a gray area and have to file a UBIT return. Some other things that nonprofits, especially when they're starting out, may not necessarily be aware of, and it's not necessarily a tax, it's just an additional annual return or annual report that needs to be filed. So most nonprofits need to be registered with either the Secretary of State or Consumer Affairs in the state that they're soliciting donations from or contributions from. So let's say I'm a New York nonprofit and I'm soliciting donations from New York residents, I need to be registered in the state of New York, which is an additional annual return. Now, if I go over to New Jersey and I start soliciting from New Jersey residents, I also need to seek permission from either the Secretary of State or Department of Consumer Affairs to solicit donations from their residents. So that increases my filing, my clients at year end for myself and my nonprofit.
Yeah, that's important to know. There's a lot of cities that are really quote unquote border cities like Fargo-Moorhead between North Dakota and Minnesota. You've got Kansas City that's in Kansas City. And also in Missouri, which is a huge one. You've got St. Louis and East St. Louis, which is in Illinois, and they're right there on the border. And those exist all over the country, and most people might not be aware that they need to register in both states.
Right. I just actually had this from Kansas City, and I had to ask the nonprofit, okay, where are you actually doing business in? Like, where is your nexus? for filing purposes, and then where are you seeking solicitations from? So it's a two-pronged question.
I think that's important to know. I also understand that you are very knowledgeable on GuideStar and what that might mean for a nonprofit to be on GuideStar.
Yes, GuideStars are fantastic. It's a fantastic website, and it really helps people who are making donations, your donors, understand more about your nonprofit and make it transparent. So GuideStar has this great resource where they have their seals of transparency, and they essentially rank a nonprofit based on how transparent they are. So for the bronze is basic information, and that's just basically your 990, which GuideStar will pull from the IRS website, their master business database website. You have the silver, which is your financial information. So if you're uploading annual reports, any sort of financials, maybe you had a certified financial audit, a review, or a compilation done by a CPA firm. Goals and strategies would be the gold level, and that's more strategic planning, what's going on with your nonprofit, and where do you see yourself. And then there's the platinum level, which is so exciting because that's progress and results. And one of the things that sometimes nonprofits, I think, overlook in this, when they're so busy with their mission and trying to deliver amazing results to improve and strengthen their communities, is how to track that data. So the real important thing about the platinum is that you're basically releasing that information to the public of how much money you raised and how did you serve your public. So let's say you're working with undomiciled people or you're working with a homeless shelter or something like that. It's how many people I served and how many people I served per dollar. They've requested that either you have a consultant come in and verify this information to guarantee a platinum level with GuideStar, or you could have a CPA firm do what's called upon agreed upon procedures, but we'll actually take your data and confirm the results that you say that they are. And it's considered a type of assurance work that we do. It doesn't necessarily fall under a financial audit, but we have done that sort of work for nonprofits before. It's kind of similar when, you know, if you watch the lotto and they always say like, oh, this lotto numbers were audited by some big law accounting firm, CPA firm. Kind of the same thing, except we do it for nonprofits.
This is external verification that you're doing what it is that you say you're doing.
Exactly. And some really big things that smaller nonprofits may not necessarily tackle in the first couple of years in existence, but they should be on their radar to help them, because there are questions on the 990, if they are filing that will ask these questions. And some of them are conflict of interest policy, whistleblower policy, document retention and destruction policy, executive compensation policy, procedures for monitoring the use of grants, and then a gift acceptance policy, which is, basic things that you kind of want to know. And the gift acceptance policy is important because let's say you have someone who's like, I love your nonprofit, I love what you stand for, but I want to give you $100,000 donation, but I only want to use it for people who are left-handed, who have blue eyes, and drive XYZ type of car. And you're like, wow, that is such an amazing donation. However, we don't service that population. How are we going to make that money work? And then what happens is it gets tied up in your balance sheet and you can't use it unless you have that population there. Having that policy in place kind of helps you navigate it before someone comes in and makes that donation. And I've seen it happen more times than one where the board's trying to scramble and the board members are either trying to talk that person out of putting a restriction on the donation or saying, listen, we are so grateful for that donation, but we can't use it effectively, and they actually have to turn it away.
Mm. There's not a whole lot of boards out there that want to turn away that kind of money.
That is very true, but I have seen it done because they just really can't handle that sort of limitation because it prevents them from focusing on their mission and creating the impact that they want. Sometimes funds that you receive are restricted. So sometimes with places of worship, which is also considered a nonprofit, they have something called a cemetery fund. And that's actually considered in New York a restricted fund. So very, very specific guidelines on what it can be used for and how it can be used. It is common in nonprofits to have that. The other sometimes where you'll see where it may not be a restricted gift, but a grant. Grants have very strict guidelines of what they can be used for, and it has to be documented accordingly. So that's another thing that, sometimes grants are received, and in the course of the year I've seen happen, either the mission's changed or something's changed within the organization, and they're not necessarily servicing that type of people, but they're trying to because now they have this grant. there's a lot of miscommunication and a lot of stuff that can create accounting problems and headaches for especially smaller nonprofits when they start trying to get into restricted funds or restricted assets.
I think there's this common misconception out there that nonprofits can't have money in the bank, that they can't pay employees, and they can't really have overhead. Wow. I know that that's not the truth, right? But it seems pretty close to half of the people I talk to think that they can't take a paycheck and can't pay employees. When someone's starting to do this and actually looking at paying certain people, like commonly an executive director is a paid position, what kind of guidelines do you recommend for how they should take maybe $100,000 worth of income donations to the place? Where would you put how much is going to some kind of staff or overhead and how much is going to the actual vision and the mission?
Sounded like there were two or three questions in that. So the first one is the fiscal reserve. So that misconception that nonprofits have to spend everything that they have and they can't save money for a rainy day, quote unquote, is not true. Listen, if they applied for a grant through a state agency or through a foundation, yes, they have to use every penny of that grant. That can't go back to their rainy day fund, so to speak. But they can set aside contributions. And what I encourage nonprofits to do is to incorporate into their fiscal policy either a 5% savings to start or whatever they can afford. So when things happen, they have money in the bank to pay people. I've seen too many nonprofits where their concentration is strictly on grants or strictly on donors, and then they lose that one grant or that donor, and then they're struggling and they can barely survive. And they're going concern, which is their ability to operate in the future for unlimited time, is jeopardized. So that's one. So fiscal policies with an actual savings plan attached to it is super, super important. And once you get the board into a habit of saving and being mindful of costs, your budget will just take, it's just a paradigm shift in the way the board operates and the nonprofit operates. So that's huge, because eventually what it will lead is to a nice sum of money in the bank where you can reinvest it conservatively and possibly down the road many years into an endowment fund, which is where we want a lot of nonprofits to hopefully end up, because we want their mission to be in existence for as long as there's a need for it. Now, the other thing that you brought up was executive compensation. So executive compensation is usually set by the board. And that has to do with a lot of different things. So it has to do with what the executive is doing. It has to do with the size of the nonprofit. It has to do with even the board, how they operate. Some boards are very hands-on and they do a lot of work. Some boards aren't. They, you know, they're more of, we're here to raise funds and make sure you guys are compliant. So there's a lot of different things to take into it. There's usually some sort of benchmarking for whatever that nonprofit is, and they'll compare nonprofits of similar size and similar missions to see if they actually have a similar compensation for them. And if the board can afford it, is it reasonable, you know, for them to afford it? Now, the other thing you talked about was the allocation of expenses, which I'm so excited about, because that'll eventually lead to our functional expense conversation. When we talk about allocating salaries, listen, in a small nonprofit, so many people do so many different things. We all wear different hats, right? So you might have someone who's like, okay, I'm doing marketing today, but, you know, later on today, I'm going to our fundraising event. And then, like, tomorrow, I'm working on our program, you know, and I'll be in, you know, the school district, or I'll be at, you know, whatever setting where we're operating in. So it's really important. And what I've done with other nonprofits when they have this sort of issues where everyone's wearing so many different hats is I create different departments in their payroll. And I will say, okay, you know, when you're working on fundraising, if you're doing fundraising things, let's just clock in with your, you know, your hand reader or whatever, that you're doing a fundraising event. Or I will ask them to keep track of it. You know, usually most nonprofit professionals have a calendar of events, and then we'll allocate their salary based on that, based on whether it's general admin, they're doing office work, whether it's fundraising, or whether it's program expense. And those are basically the three categories for functional expenses. And functional expenses are so important, especially nowadays. My favorite saying is, numbers don't lie, but liars can figure. And what that means is that numbers themselves tell a story, right? when you read financial statements, I usually read the footnotes first or the notes in the back of the financials before even looking at the financials themselves, because I want the context of what these numbers mean. I want to understand what's going on. If I see a decrease in contributions or if I see an increase in accounts payable or an increase in loans, I want to understand what's going on to this and why it's happening. And the notes will tell a story. So it's really super important that when nonprofits, especially starting out, and they're incurring these expenses, try to put those expenses into the certain categories, whether they're general admin, and that's just basically the day-to-day operation of running your nonprofit. So some of your accounting overhead might be charged there. Some of the rent might be charged there. Some of the insurance, you know, some of your office staff salary. Then you have fundraising. So when you go and you're like, okay, I'm going to do a gala, all the gala expenses would be pushed there. And then when you have your program, so if your program is servicing, you know, underserved communities, whatever you're out in the expenses incurred for doing that. So part of the salary of people, part of your workers, part of, you know, if there's any costs associated with that, that gets started there. From there, what us accountants like to do, and many others who actually do consulting with nonprofits, we like to kind of view those expenses and where they are in terms of your contribution. So we'll do different ratio tests and analysis to see if they're within a certain measure. Typically, we like to see G&A around 20% or less. And sometimes that's like, people are like, oh my gosh, that's so hard. And it is. Sometimes it's a matter of the way that you're operating may not be efficient. Sometimes it's just that the tech costs of things are so expensive, and there needs to be a cost savings plan in place. And other times it's just, they're in a different cycle. So within nonprofits, there's just a whole cycle like a business. You know, you could be on the up cycle, you could be on a down cycle, you could be a cycle of growth, a cycle of not growth. So it's just a matter of kind of knowing where you are and having those functional expenses be able to help us and help your team, your nonprofit team, figure out what's going on and how to help strategically. The other thing is that when you're doing your annual reports, that hopefully every nonprofit is, even if you're 20,000, at least put a one-page annual report together. That combined with your 990 EZ will be so helpful to donors and know what you do, how you operate, how many people you served, how many people you've helped, you know, highlight programs that you accomplished. That's so beneficial and makes people want to give money and want to be involved with what you're doing. When people look at a tax return, they don't see that connection. There's no story behind it. So that's why I love comparing taking the functional expenses from the tax return or from your financials and combining it with the annual report, including pictures and graphics, and make people get excited about what you're doing.
Oh, is that it? I'm like, holy crap.
That's a lot.
You see, that's why I bring the experts on the show. Most of all, they give me a break so I can breathe, but they actually bring real, true value. You talked about 20%. I believe you said G&A. Is that what you said, G&A? What does that mean for some of our newer nonprofits? I might not be sure what that means.
Sure. So general and admin is basically your overhead costs. So let's say you have QuickBooks subscription, right? Like you're using QuickBooks, you're using Apple, you're using some sort of accounting software. They charge you on a monthly basis, or maybe you pay once a year. So part of that's going to be allocable to your general administrative operating expense. And that's just the cost of running a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. You have someone in your office doing filing or scanning documents. It's G&A. There are ways that you can ask questions to say, okay, well, maybe they're scanning documents for our program. Maybe that's part of the program. But that also comes back to making sure that everyone's job is clearly defined. If you don't have an employee handbook or a volunteer handbook or something like that, you should probably get one, you know, and just kind of outline what each person does and try to keep track of that. You know, the other thing too, that when I say volunteer handbook, which made me think, because a lot of nonprofits at the smaller level aren't necessarily tracking their volunteer hours. Mm-hmm. It's a really, really great resource to track your volunteer hours in comparison to your mission and what you've accomplished. And even if you're a small nonprofit and you maybe only raised $2,000, that's okay. But let's say you had 2,000 volunteers and each person donated an hour of their time. And now you've got 2,000 hours of volunteer work. That's amazing. That's huge. So there's different ways to evaluate the success and how impactful a nonprofit actually is.
See, impact is something I care about. As a donor myself, when I look at a nonprofit and I build a relationship and I want to see what they're doing, I want to be assured that my dollars are going to impact lives. In the military, there's this combined federal campaign. And in there, you have a great book, and it gives you about a paragraph or so about what a nonprofit might do. And if you are a nonprofit listening to this, maybe you want to be included in the CFC, the combined federal campaign. But there's also in there, it says your expense ratio. It says if you're spending 80 cents on every dollar that's coming in towards your overhead, and like 20% is going to your mission. Like, it tells the donor if you're using money for the people you're trying to help or if you're just using it for yourselves. And please understand, you should absolutely hire a legal team or a lawyer and get the absolute stuff that you need for that. You should have insurance, especially if you're doing events. You might have building rent. You might have Zoom premium or whatever it is that you have for you. Spend the money that you need to spend to do the things that you need to do. You as a CEO and janitor of the nonprofit that you're running, you cannot do it all and be sustainable. You can do it all, but you're going to burn out. Find the things that you're really good at doing. Hire out the rest. It's perfectly okay. Spend legitimate money on CPA services and legal services, and by all means, insurance. Oh, Lord, I can't even tell you. Buy the insurance. If you're doing an outdoor concert, a summer concert, buy the insurance. If people are like, why would I buy the insurance? You get rained out on a fluke thing, and all of a sudden you've got 20 grand into this concert that you've made $0 on. But if you spend the, I'm making up a number here, right? If you spent the $200 on insurance, you're out $200 instead of $20,000. Buy the insurance, protect yourselves, and do the right things. One of the things Nicole and I talked about in a pre-interview was the importance of internal controls and end-of-month accountability. Nicole, what can you tell us about internal controls and end-of-month accountability?
So internal controls is such a hot topic right now, especially with smaller nonprofits. So as a nonprofit, right, you guys act as a fiduciary with someone else's money. What does that mean? It means that the money is not the nonprofit, even though you have custodian, you have possession of it. You're supposed to act in the best interest of the community that gave you that money. So you have a fiduciary responsibility with it. So what we see is with smaller nonprofits who are starting out is that everyone trusts everyone. Everyone's so passionate about the mission. And they have the same person writing the check, opening the deposits, doing the bank reconciliation, and signing all the checks. So we go in and we're like, ooh, this is an opportunity for someone to take advantage of this nonprofit, right? And because everyone's so trustworthy, it may not be on their radar that someone would even be thinking in that sort of manner. Mm-hmm. So what we like to do is we always advise that nonprofits, no matter what size you are, always have a checks and balance and internal controls. So what does that mean? It means the same person that opens those deposits from the donors who are you're so grateful to receive the checks from, isn't the same person that's filling out the deposit ticket or isn't the same person that's recording it in QuickBooks. The same thing with the checks. So we recommend the same person who's recording the invoice into QuickBooks or whatever accounting solution you use isn't the same person who's necessarily signing the check, right? The same person that's opening the bank statements and confirming the transactions out on there isn't the same person that's reconciling the bank accounts on a month-end basis. We recommend that all sensitive information, whether it's donor information, if you have credit cards on file, for them, or blank checks, if you have a nonprofit credit card, everything be locked up and only certain people have access to them. We recommend that usually that there's, depending on your nonprofit and the level of checks that you write, that at some point there's a dual signature threshold. If you're a larger nonprofit, you do write a lot of checks. There's something that you can do called positive pay, where you essentially have to tell the bank what checks you are writing, and they'll only clear those checks that come through essentially. We've seen that that's just financial internal controls, I should say, too. There's also a whole other IT internal controls that we are starting to look at and make recommendations and recommend that they work with experts in that field to also help. So something just touch upon that, you know, internal control for IT could be entry points for people who have passwords to certain software or people who have passwords to certain access on the server. Email, what happens if you terminate an employee? How do you ensure that they don't have access to certain things anymore? So there's a whole level and a whole kind of walkthrough that we do with nonprofits to ensure that they're safe and they're not putting themselves at additional exposure.
What have you seen from your experience as and either an unintentional flaw or a flagrant abuse of a system that they haven't had these internal controls.
Certain key staff of nonprofits have run personal expenses through the nonprofit, and we've had to accomplish that. I have seen where through negligence, there's just been expenses that weren't vetted. So meaning that no one got the three estimates, no one did the proper due diligence to make sure that they were getting the right sort of price for whatever they were bidding on. I have seen misappropriation of assets, which is saying a perfect example of misappropriation of assets is, let's say, and this is kind of sound funny, but I've seen this, the nonprofit, right? They operate, they buy toilet paper for their bathroom, right? The public bathroom, it's, you know, helps the program. So when the kids come in, they have a bathroom. When the office staff, they have bathrooms, you know, whatever. Okay. There were employees taking the toilet paper home because they didn't want to purchase their own toilet paper. So there's a misappropriation of assets there. Even time is a misappropriation of assets. So let's say you're salaried and you're supposed to accomplish X amount of hours of work every week to help the nonprofit. And instead you're on Facebook doing personal things, but still receiving that salary. So you're not producing work. There's some of that. And there's just some larger issues where there was just outright embezzlement and collusion going on because there weren't strong internal controls. Mm-hmm. Also, it could be at a larger level, which we have not seen this or been brought into this, but where you have nonprofits that are established and they're really just the front to kind of funnel money through, and then someone's just using it for their own personal benefit. And on Long Island, where I am, the biggest one that we had was for, there was a nonprofit for breast cancer awareness, and they were in the news several years ago because of this. And I believe the attorney general, and you know, it was a big to do. A lot of money was taken and not used for its intended purpose. So it's always something because you work so hard to raise that money and you want to give it back. So internal controls is just so important to actually have in place in there. You know, and then I've seen little things happen where it's not necessarily intentional. It's just negligent where the person's going to the bank. They're a trustworthy person. They're going to the bank. They're making the deposit for the nonprofit. And for whatever reason, they lost the checks. Things like that. So it's always good to have internal controls. Duplicity is fantastic if you can set it up in your procedure somehow. And make sure if you do have people that are in a financial position, whether it's the ED that has access to funds or a bookkeeper or an internal accountant, you might want to consider having them bonded if something happens. And it's just an additional type of insurance policy you can take out. Yeah. So.
You see, those are the kind of stories and those are the kind of things that people need to hear. Not because it's scary or terrifying, but even something that's an honest mistake can really come back and bite you or really just tear down a nonprofit. It hits the media. It's totally unintentional. It's fixable, but all of a sudden the media gets a hold of it and the name is ruined and there's nothing you can do to fix it at that point. But you had mentioned in our pre-interview talking about end of month accountability. What does that look like?
So I love my executive directors. They are fantastic. They are pulled in so many directions though that sometimes because maybe finances and accounting isn't their cup of tea, or maybe it's an area of weakness for them, they don't focus as much on it. So what I develop with my nonprofits and the EDs and the bookkeepers and whoever's on their team that's handling this, I develop an end-of-month accountability program. And what that is a checklist of things that both the accountant, bookkeeper, you know, whoever's internal handling that role, and the ED or a board member, whoever, again, because some nonprofits, people wear many different hats, but two people go through the checklist and they kind of go through everything. So it's basically whoever opened the bank statement, initials the envelope or prints it out, initials it, does something, acknowledges it on the checklist. The person that reconciled the bank account acknowledges it on the checklist. And then the person that's reviewing the reconciliation after the fact acknowledges it on the checklist. And we go through the whole trial balance. So they're basically doing ticking and tying their whole trial balance to tie everything out, right? And you're going to ask a follow-up question, Nicole, what's a trial balance? What's on a trial balance?
You know me so well.
Yes. So trial balance is just basically another accounting report, which lists all the accounts that you have in your nonprofit. So it starts with your assets, works its way through the liabilities in the equity section, and then your income and expenses. What I do is I train the bookkeepers who may be amazing and have great experience and already know what they're doing, or could be a layperson coming in who's just like, listen, I just want to volunteer a couple hours a week, and I got handed the treasurer/bookkeeper position. So I train them. And so this way, there's dual accountability within their organization. And at the end of the month, there's a clear communication plan in place of what's happening, what's going on. And then the treasurer at some point will get involved and review it as well before the monthly treasurer report, or how often they get the treasurer report. These are usually for smaller nonprofits who are starting out, who kind of need a little bit more guidance because this is the first time doing everything. At the mid to larger scale, you know, we still do the report. We still have a program that we check off when we go down, and we ensure that everything ties back to a work paper and two people have reviewed it. But they're usually, they've been with me for a while, so they kind of already know the deal at that point. But it helps. It's a great way for them to acknowledge it and also have, like, I don't want to say force that conversation at month end, or usually the first or second week of the following month, depending when their close out, their accounting cycle ends. But it makes all parties aware that this is important and you have to do it.
Well, I think accountability is one of the most important aspects of not just nonprofit work, but life in general. If you're held accountable for the things that you plan on doing, if you're losing weight and you have an accountability partner, you guys are working out together, you're that much better. Right? If you have an accountability partner and you're in nonprofit, or it's a team or it's designed or whatever it looks like, you're more accountable to the things that you've decided to do. And if you've taken the time to brainstorm and lay out a plan and design the things that it is that you want to do and to accomplish, accountability just makes sure you're on your way to exactly what it is that you want to do and what you're looking for. And the sooner you catch a mistake or gross negligence or some kind of thievery, the sooner you catch it, always the better it is. You get back on track, you change board members or executive directors if need be, and you're on and moving again towards that goal that you have.
It's so true and it's so important. And, you know, sometimes it's even the banks make errors. You know, I found banking errors. So sometimes when you have maybe a little bit larger nonprofit and the accounting system is a little bit more complicated and you have transactions being imported from, you know, the donor management into your accounting software package, things don't always import correctly. Technology doesn't always work the way it's supposed to work. So having that formal month-end close and two sets of eyes looking at it, you're usually able to identify it so much sooner.
I'm with you. Absolutely. So tell me, Nicole, how can we at the Nonprofit Architect help you?
Sure. So I'm all about giving back. So if I could kindly plug my upcoming webinar for nonprofits, that would be
absolutely
fantastic.
Absolutely. Let's hear about it.
So what I've come to find out is a lot of nonprofits love QuickBooks. And QuickBooks is a great program. It's easy to use. It's functional. And given the scheme of different accounting packages out there, it's probably one of the more affordable packages for nonprofits, especially starting out. And TechSoup has some great deals on it. So if you're 501c3 and you have your 501c3 letter, you can go to TechSoup and you can get a really great deal on it. So what I will be doing is through Facebook groups, through different other organizations, there are so many questions about how to use QuickBooks online and how to gear it towards nonprofits, because typically it's really meant for for-profit businesses. So I will be doing about a 45-minute webinar with questions at the end to kind of help nonprofits starting out or maybe seasoned nonprofits be more efficient. And I'm happy to include a link that you might be able to post somewhere.
I'm definitely going to include a link. I can't remember. Are you in my Facebook group for the Nonprofit Architect podcast?
I am. I'm so excited. It's one of my favorite groups now. I actually listen to the podcast now. I'm in the group. I listen to it while I do tax returns at work. It's fantastic.
Well, thank you so much. I'm excited about that. But feel free to post your promotion for your webinar in the group. When's your webinar going to be?
It will probably be Tuesday, March 17th. It will be live. And then what we will do is we will also have a recording of it. And this way, if people can't attend or, you know, it's during the workday or they're busy, EDs and nonprofit people are always busy. They're so overworked. I have so much, credit.
Especially on St. Patty's Day.
Oh, you know what? Me being an accountant, I didn't even think of that. One of the tax deadlines. Oh. We don't get to celebrate St. Patrick's Day when you're an accountant. January through April, you just work. so maybe we might reschedule that for Wednesday then. Thank you for pointing that out. We might do that for Wednesday. That's fine.
Look, I wasn't even tracking that, but I followed on the calendar. I was like, oh, look, that's St. Patty's Day.
Yeah, we don't, you know what? We just work through January through April. Like, we work all the time, but our hours increase drastically during the
time. I imagine. And it should. And that's okay. Just a couple of months, right?
Just a couple of months.
Yeah. Yeah. So where can people, what is the best way, the number one way, the thing you check the most, where can people find you and get a hold of you?
Sure. So I'm really accessible to nonprofits or to my clients. So you can find me on LinkedIn, Nicole Hyde, NICHOLEHBID. You can also find me on Facebook, or I'm happy to give you my email address if you want to include it. People can always reach out. What I do is, you know, I'm always happy to help nonprofits, especially starting out. I usually do a 15, 20 minute consultation pro bono, no charge, just kind of see where you guys are and try to offer any value I can. If you want to come in and be a client, that's amazing. We would love to have you and love to welcome you to the Rose Zeldropoulos family, and you would be in great company. But I understand with some nonprofits, they want to try to do it themselves first. And, you know, some things, it's not as cost effective, and they can try to get a pro bono accountant to do certain things. So, you know, but we're always happy to help. You can also find me in Travis's group and a few other nonprofit groups on Facebook. So if I post regularly. I also have a 990 group called 990 Central on Facebook, where I will post different articles and answer questions that nonprofits have about their 990 and different compliance issues relating to either the audit side or the tax side, or even just general consulting questions when it comes to nonprofits. So.
I only got one more question for you, Nicole. And okay. I mean, want to say thank you so much for all the value you're providing today. What is the number one mistake nonprofits make when it comes to accounting?
Not to say that there's so many of them, but I would say the first mistake that nonprofits make is not hiring or not engaging an accountant, a skilled professional, when they're first starting out. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to pay for an accountant or a CPA or an enrolled agent or somebody, you know, to come do the work right away. However, what you can do is that when you're seeking, and this tag goes off of your post that I saw a couple weeks ago about boards. Yeah. So when you're forming your board, there are certain professionals that you really want on your board. You want someone who's just passionate about your mission and who loves the work that you're doing and loves helping. You want someone who's a skilled financial professional. If you can't get an accountant, you can't get a skilled bookkeeper, maybe ask the local banker. Most banks have a community act where they have to give back to their community, and they'll usually begrudgingly, but they usually will sit on a board as a treasurer if asked very, very nicely. You know, you want to have an attorney. You can see if you can get some sort of attorney to sit on your board. Depending on what type of work you do, it might be beneficial to have a social worker. You know, if you're geared towards music, maybe get a musician. So there's certain skilled professionals that you want to have and that you may not be able to afford to pay for the services right away, but there's other ways to try to incorporate them and work within your budget and within the guidelines of your nonprofit. So I would say the number one mistake that nonprofits do make in the very beginning is not having a skilled professional in the accountant, either paying for their source, their services, or getting them on the board somehow and getting them involved.
Well, thank you, Nicole, so much. Nonstop content, nonstop value. I love having you on.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate your time. I appreciate you having me. It was a fantastic experience.
You've been listening to The Nonprofit Architect. To listen to all our past shows, visit http://nonprofitarchitect.org. And be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. Thank you.